Mine has been a life of much shame. I can't even guess myself what it must be to live the life of a human being. I was born in a village in the northeast, and it wasn't until I was quite big that I saw my first train. I climbed up and down the station bridge, quite unaware that its function was to permit people to cross from one track to another. I was convinced that the bridge had been provided to lend an exotic touch and to make the station premises a place of pleasant diversity, like some foreign playground. I remained under this delusion for quite a long time, and it was for me a very refined amusement indeed to climb up and down the bridge. I thought that it was one of the most elegant services provided by the railways. When later I discovered that the bridge was nothing more than a utilitarian device, I lost all interest in it. The opening there to Osamu Dazai's No Longer Human, from originally published 1948, also translated as A Shameful Life, translated from the Japanese. I've got the translation by Donald Keane, which is the first ever English translation, and that's from New Directions Publishers. So this has become somewhat of a cult classic in the, to be honest, edgy, pessimistic, misanthropic literature genre, where we would see the likes of someone like Welbeck would be, I think, someone to put alongside Dazai. And I have to say, before really getting into this book, that this is going to be the first unsure review. And I would also say it's going to be the first critical review. When I first read this book, when I first read it, I got halfway through and I put it down. And I thought, I'm going to have to restart that in a couple of weeks or whatever, because it was one of those cases where I was reading something that had been heralded and has hundreds of thousands of reviews and had been heralded as this sort of, as I say, a misanthropic masterpiece. For those interested in pessimistic literature, particularly a real great text. So 2 weeks in, after the first read, halfway through, roughly, I just wasn't getting anything. I wasn't getting anything from it. And I thought, well, I'll come back to it. And the same thing happened again on this reading. I got about halfway through and I was exhausted. Even though it's just under 180 pages and it's not badly written. I must emphasize that there is a jilted, tense, sinewy style that really does carry you along. And yet, for myself, about halfway through, once again, I found myself just being absolutely exhausted from the combination of the misanthropy, the horrible and utterly bitter casual misogyny, and the general helpless tone that I'm not and still not entirely sure what the desire was entirely trying to do. But I must say before I go forward that I've only read Desire's biography in brief from the Wikipedia. I understand that he was an extremely depressed individual who eventually committed suicide. And ultimately, as his last piece of writing, or at least his last, I believe his last published novel in this form of notebooks left behind by the protagonist, so really a semi-autobiographical novel, this book ultimately is a literary suicide note from an extremely unwell and depressed individual design. So at that point, I'm hesitant for some of the criticisms, or hesitant to make some of the criticisms. And yet, I feel at a certain point, there's a danger of this book being read in a certain sense, because there's something, if I had to describe this book in a single word, it would be sick. It's a sick, unwell book. And I'm not sure if that's positive or negative. Desire was extremely unwell, and this book is just palpably unwell. And in a sentence, it encapsulates a mind, as in a human mind, that you do not want to be in any longer than about 177 pages. I have never wanted to stop reading a book as much as I wanted to stop reading this one, in exactly the same way of wanting to get away from an individual who you feel is deeply, deeply unwell and you can't help, and you don't really want to be near them anymore. Now, maybe that is something to behold in terms of what a literary what a piece of literature can do. It's quite a feat. But I will go through the plot, and then, as usual, I've got notes and thoughts. So, No Longer Human, also translated as A Shameful Life, 1948. Basically, it's just the short tale, story, of a very, very troubled man. Very alienated, very tense, does not fit in. This constant idea of otherness, of Oba Yozo, who's a protagonist, Oba, being apart from others, never fitting in, having to perform, you know, being the butt of jokes, feeling himself a sense of paranoia, a sense of deep depression, suicidal ideations, a hatred of life, and just, but most importantly, an alienation that is so intense that almost the book itself can't hold together. So it's split into three notebooks, the book. So the first notebook, and there is spoilers here. The first notebook, we are introduced to Oba, and immediately we are told of this alienation, of how he finds himself surrounded by others that he just can't connect to. And we're introduced to his early years, where he has to establish himself in some sense. And the way that he establishes himself is by basically being a clown, by being a buffoon, by performing and not knowing what to say, but by amusing people in these sort of horrible, almost slapstick gestures, and establishing this mood, which is ultimately coming only from him, that he is the butt of all jokes, and that he is not human, he's no longer human as per the title, that his life is one of shame and guilt and not understanding, and that he is separate from human beings, and he's constantly perplexed, and because of this he is a fool. And he then acts, you know, in this way that he understands himself as not being a human. He acts in a way to just get by, so that he won't be reprimanded, that he won't be told off, that the emotions of humans won't rise around him via the things he does. And so his whole life is this one of a shame that he's internalizing, because he can't keep up with, he can't, he truly does not understand. He's so alienated that he doesn't understand what it is to be a human. There is a lot of awful things and events that happen to him throughout the novel. He's sexually abused by a male servant and a female servant during his childhood. And then when he thinks about reporting it, he understands that that would be useless. And there is this line of defeatism throughout the whole book, of an acceptance of this fate that he has constructed for himself in terms of his own alienation. When we move through to the second book, and the book does move fast, and I'll talk about the language style once I've just gone through the plot. So in the second notebook, Oba becomes increasingly concerned with whether or not this facade, this facade that he's had to upkeep, because he doesn't see himself as human and he struggles to fit in, whether or not that will be able to be penetrated, to be ruined by others, when Takeshi, one of his sort of schoolmates, sees through this falseness, this buffoonery that he's doing just to appease the human life that he's alienated from. And so he befriends him to stop this sort of secret from being let out. And then eventually, soon, Oba begins to paint via a sort of detour into the works of Van Gogh. Begins to paint to express himself through art, and he paints a self-portrait which is so dreadful that he dares not show it to anyone. But he shows it to his friend, who predicts that he'll be a great artist one day. And this dreadful portrait is reminiscent of the just before the part that I read. There's an opening with regards to some photographs of the protagonist from an external voice who's talking about finding these notebooks. And at the beginning, this other voice who is introducing these notebooks and talking about this man that we're talking about in these notebooks, in this prologue, I have seen three pictures of the man is the first line of the book before Oba, the protagonist in the notebooks, actually starts talking. This voice talks about the three pictures. And one is in childhood, one is then in adolescence, one is as a man. And each of these, as these photographs grow, it's this tense, inhuman, half-smiling but not really smiling, uncanny photographic portraits of a sort of just an odd, almost Lovecraftian being. That if you were to take that Lovecraftian feeling of something being completely not right, but then remove, you know, any notions of the Cthulhu mythos and beings and gods and all that strange odd stuff, remove that and just be left with that uncanny being that should not be. And this is what these photos describe. And so Oba then paints this self-portrait that is just so dreadful. You know, he is just completely, he's a force of alienation in the world. After finishing high school, he's sent to Tokyo to visit the university, becomes influenced by other painters there. And he descends into, as per pessimistic literature, the typical pattern of drinking and smoking, begins attending communist meetings. And this is, as the book is semi-autobiographical, this was a part of Desire's life as well. But he never becomes a staunch follower. And so nothing sticks ultimately throughout the novel. I'll talk about this with the style when I get to it. After spending the night with a married woman, he attempts to commit double suicide with her by drowning, which is extremely close, if not entirely one-to-one, with how Desire actually died, which was found in a ditch with another woman, a double suicide. He survives this double suicide in the book, and she dies, leaving him feeling even more guilty and shameful than he already did. And then we go through to the third notebook, which is split into two parts. So in part one, Oba is expelled from the university, and he is then taken under the care of a friend of the family. He tries to have normal relationships with a single mother, becoming a surrogate father to a little girl, but he soon returns to these pessimistic nihilist habits of drinking and alienation and his understanding of humanity, and ultimately abandons them. He then lives with a madame of a bar before meeting Yoshiko, a young woman who wants him to stop drinking. And then when we move through to the final part of the book, the third notebook, thanks to this grounding influence of Yoshiko, Oba stops drinking, finds work as a cartoonist. But Horiki, someone else who is from the book, shows up and puts him right back onto the pattern of this awful behavior. So it's this up and down cycle, sine wave of grounding and non-alienation and stable life, and then back to it. Yoshiko is then sexually assaulted by a casual acquaintance, which is witnessed by Oba. And he does nothing really about it. And the terror and despair brought about by this incident estranges Oba from his wife, leads to another suicide attempt. He's then released from hospital, where after the suicide attempt, Oba becomes a morphine addict, confined to a mental institution, released, moves to an isolated location with his brother's help. And the book finishes with him in really a state of apathy, of saying that he feels neither happy nor unhappy. I'll read another excerpt before I go into the style. In other words, you might say that I still have no understanding of what makes human beings tick. My apprehension on discovering that my concept of happiness seems to be completely at variance with that of everyone else was so great as to make me toss sleeplessly and groan night after night in my bed. It drove me indeed to the brink of lunacy. I wonder if I have actually been happy. People have told me, really more times than I can remember, ever since I was a small boy, how lucky I was, but I've always felt as if I was suffering in hell. It has seemed to me, in fact, that those who called me lucky were incomparably more fortunate than I. And then a few lines later, he says a sentence which I think would describe a more positive or more sympathetic spin on his position in life. I simply don't understand. That would be the most sympathetic spin on Ober and Desai's appreciation of this depressive life journey. Now, the thing is, when you go through that plot of basically just one of these single most miserable lives in literature, filled to the brim of unforgivable moments of shame, of guilt, of paranoia, of alienation, of not a single moment of comfort or vitality or lust for life or enjoyment or anything even possibly surrounding that, nothing being built, no ambition, no creation. You wonder how it is you're being carried along. Well, you know, it takes a lot for a book to be able to do that. And I think of someone like in terms of the style and explaining what he's, if you were to explain what he's doing and wondering how you can be carried along by that, Thomas Bernhard is an example, but I don't want to put these two together at all. And actually, he's an interesting case for when I talk about pessimistic literature in relation to this book. So the style I would describe the style as empirical. There's a lot of these little details. There's not massively a rhythm, but you could describe this as a rhythm. There is this just a beat of a banal life. I got up today, then I went to work, then bang, 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 bang. And before you, even though nothing massively is happening, there's not any real moments of huge flair. There's, you know, like in paintings, if you think of the paintings of Turner, there's these moments of tension, of bang, like a deep black or a bright white that carry you in. And I don't feel these moments of tension are in the book to carry you along. So the question is, how have I got here? And it's very, very clever. I'll give Desai that in terms of this style, because the style itself is absolutely representative of what the protagonist is going through. Before you know it, 80 pages have passed. Seemingly lots has happened in his life and he has grown and maybe or not matured. He's still alienated. But you're almost halfway through the book and you're nowhere. Nothing has been taken in. You feel really no different towards the protagonist and you're not. You care, well, speaking for myself, I didn't care either way what happened to him. The life was one of absolute nothingness. So the question and the point why I'm more critical of this book and why it is interesting, at least, you know, as a piece of literature, is to do with thematically placing it amidst other books. So, considering the theme and the plot of the book, I think this is a text that can be placed amidst pessimistic, cynical, and nihilistic literature. Welbeck, Chiron, Ligotti, Bernhard, writers like this sometimes would be considered edgy writers. Herman Berger. Many that I've tackled on the podcast, as many people know, I love pessimistic literature. Cormac McCarthy, even, in terms of much of his pessimism. But there's a distinct difference. There is a distinct difference as to why I will never read this again. I have no interest in reading it again. And I would put it into the small pile of books that I would say I explicitly dislike because of a certain danger that even as a pessimistic individual who has been diagnosed with major depression before, and, you know, if you'd put it in one of those sentences, suffered from depression at times, I feel this is a dangerous book. And what do I mean by that? When we look at the likes of someone like Chiron, Chiron is working through something. Chiron is ultimately, I think it could almost be noted as one of the most pessimistic and arguably nihilistic, maybe even antinatalist, very rough and ready, writers there is, you know. I mean, he's writing books with titles like On the Heights of Despair and The Trouble with Being Born. And yet, one gets the impression when reading Chiron's aphorisms and writing that he's he's working through something. He's been given a life and he's dealing with it as a question. You know, even if he is suffering from this deep insomnia, pardon me, this horrible insomnia and this horrible depression and this nihilism, which is haunting him minute after minute, he's dealing with the question of life as a question. His aphorisms speak to constantly trying to find something, trying to find some way through, trying to deal with it. Thomas Bernhard, I mean, when you first read Bernhard, I described him in my chat with Steve Dowden as a miserable writer. And yet, the more I read Bernhard, the more I realize that his miserabilism and his cynical nature and his pessimism plays a larger role in what Dowden pointed out as outrage at how the world has been formed. And Bernhard then is working through the question of human relationships amidst this sort of this horrible world. He's working through that and is once again, like Chiron, taking up a question. Thomas Ligotti, through his horror, is dealing with the emotions of that palpable uncanniness and in a more cosmic sense, how a human being relates to that absolute insignificance. What is that relationship? There's always a relationship between that position of the human being and the world, and that's what forms the pessimism, is that relationship. Hermann Berger ultimately is taking up a question, which is the end question of pessimism currently, which is, you know, we go through like existentialism. What's the, you know, God is dead, then so God is dead, so the question of God is gone, then existentialism, the what is it to be a human being now anymore, then maybe through like hedonism and then decadence. And then ultimately, I think for Hermann Berger, the final question is boredom. What do we do after boredom? And that's the question he's taking up. And maybe post-boredom, you could say Welbeck is one of the post-boredom writers, and it ends in this sort of more of a postmodern chaos. There isn't a relationship for desire. There isn't a relationship with this book. I don't think he's taking up a question. Now, on the one hand, if it was just a straightforward pessimistic text and it wasn't taking up a question, I probably wouldn't have done the review and I would have stopped reading it. And this is why, for me, it's on a tightrope between extremely honest understanding of what it is to be a depressed, alienated human being, and being honest myself, falling to the other side, a rather self-serving, pathetic, hateful novel. And that seems like a harsh thing to say, considering the reality of desire. But there's something that goes on through the book that is unforgivable in a way, and it makes one question why it's there. I don't know enough about desire, and I'm sure this must have been written about. But if these elements were removed, we'd be left with maybe something closer to a Dostoevsky and very short novella of what a depressive life is. But the protagonist, Ober, has a misogyny that is utterly, utterly bitter and sick. And at the times where he has any energy, if that is such a thing, it is just quickly vomited up in the most empty statements of hatred towards women. He says at one point, "I never could think of prostitutes as human beings or even as women. They seemed more like imbeciles or lunatics." And these kind of quotes are peppered throughout the book. And there's, with these, enters something else into the novel, which leaves you with this horrible taste in your mouth, with ultimately not wanting to spend time with the person anymore. There's any notion of sympathy is quickly as far as I'm concerned, is quickly dissipated by this entry of, hang on, behind all this is this sickening, self-serving bitterness that I don't want anything really to do with. And so, at first you're given this sick, extremely sick, alienated, inhuman, no longer human being that is emphasized by this being's relationship to food is one of the elements. Oberg is constantly talking about how he doesn't understand eating. He never feels like he's been hungry. So that most human of things is not something he's ever related to. He doesn't even relate to eating. He doesn't understand eating. And so from this, with that entry of the misogyny, it's not pessimism. It's not nihilism. It's a book of disgust and hatred of having to exist. As if everything's a burden and someone else is to blame and there has to be a scapegoat. And I think the scapegoat ultimately ends with the misogyny. That's the answer of where any energy that Ober culminates is directed. And so this is why I was that's the main reason I was critical of the book, is it is the book I've least enjoyed spending time with. And if it was any less well known, I wouldn't have done the review at all. And I sort of hope in a way that I've missed something or missing something. I think it is a suicide note for Desire. It's his final suicide note for a man who then very shortly after did commit suicide. I may have got the dates messed around here. So for people who know the biography better of Desire better than me, I apologize. But this final suicide note of a mind that you really don't want to be inside. And it's still on a tightrope for me, because on the one hand, it is an extremely sad and detailed insight into what the depressive mind can do at its extreme, how it makes one feel. This complete, you are completely alienated. There is no relationships. There is no one cares about you. You're a fool. You know, life is one of shame and guilt and misanthropy and sin. Nothing's ever going to work, and cynicism, etc. But at the same time, because of that lack of relationship which Desire allows, he then interns all of that. And so all of this is just this spindling, spinning thing just within his own world inside. Now, that in itself is extremely interesting. It's very Dostoevsky. And from that, you think, oh, this is kind of maddening, non-relating, with no otherness. I'm no longer human, this weird being who's developing an understanding of the world just from their own inside. I mean, this is very almost like deluded, nihilistic madness. And that's an interesting idea. And yet, the problem with that is certain relationships are let in with a certain certainty that is reprehensible. Okay, you have this like spindling infolding of all of Ober's understanding of the world, and yet there is this sudden like, okay, well, I do have a relationship to something. I have a relationship to women, and they're whatever, right? And it's complete misogyny all of a sudden out of the blue. And it could be the case that that's thrown in to jolt us with respect to how we feel about Ober. It could be that that's thrown in as a side of some effect of depression. Though I wouldn't agree with that. And so that element of the book completely throws the whole thing into something that becomes quite confused. Without that, maybe it would be too straightforward. You would just feel absolutely awful for this person who. But that's that's the primary criticisms of the book, is I just couldn't make sense of that. It's an extremely quiet book outside of those moments. It's kind of delicate and empirical, like it could fall apart and break. But also, with respect to a mind you don't want to be inside, I have to be honest. Like I said at the start about not being able to finish the first time. I get halfway through and I just didn't want to go forward. I didn't want to spend time with this protagonist because they were just constantly self-justifying all their problems. They were finding reasons to you know, this is why life sucks. This is, and there's no one worse to be around than someone who just constantly wants to be saying, this is why life sucks. This is why life sucks. And once again, it's back to that question of pessimism of, are you taking up a question? Are you, is there any engagement? I think you can still be pessimistic and cynical and even misanthropic, but you have to take up a question. You have to, if there's no engagement, you're just sitting with yourself, you know, I am inhuman, I'm no longer human, I don't fit in, and no, I'm not even going to try and engage, I'm just going to sit with pit of misery, and try as hard as I might to continue that sympathy with someone who's clearly deeply unwell. There's a point where you're just exhausted. And the book does that well, and that's why it's on a tightrope for me, because on the one hand, if there's an intentionality behind that, it's very well done. But on the other hand, and most of the time, it really does not feel like there is an intentionality, and that this is basically the equivalent of a 180-page whinging session from someone who needs help. And in that sense, that's why I've mentioned a couple of times, I think it's a dangerous book, because I don't think it's clarified enough to articulate just, if anything, what it's trying to say. And much like we see with American Psycho, with this psychopath becoming an idol in a very strange sense, the Sigma idol, the Oba could very much see people saying, oh, I really relate to that. It's not a good thing to relate to. It's a sick book. And in that sense, I think it's a very dangerous book, and I will risk saying that I don't think it's articulate enough to be making a point. And very much one of these cases where something that is heralded as a cult classic, and ultimately a classic and a Japanese classic. I think it's important when you read such heralded texts. I'm trying to think of another example. Another example for me would be, I mean, it's not related to it, but just this example, Siddhartha. I mean, I just think that's a rubbish book. But this, when something's held in such esteem, I don't think it's there. I don't think anything's there. And I'm hoping from this that people will comment and say, you know, you've made a mistake. You didn't see it. You missed this, or he was trying to do this, or something along these lines. But I got to the end of the book and couldn't help really feeling that it's a waste of my time. It's a waste of a life. And not only is it a waste of a life that couldn't articulate itself, while it's doing that, it is spewing some of the most bitter, horrible hatred that one can imagine from nowhere, for no discernible reason. And for that reason, I do think it's a rather dangerous book that not in the sense that people are going to pick up arms, but it's maybe going to infect people with a certain outlook that really is just needlessly antagonistic and ultimately pathetic. But you know, I risk saying that, because ultimately, Desai, you know, did end his own life and suffered greatly. So it's a tough one to place together and to fully understand. But that is my short, you could say, review or even critique of No Longer Human by Desai. Now, try and finish on some positive things. Like I said at the start, I cannot say it's badly written. It's very well written. It's remarkable that it moves you forward as fast as it does. It's remarkable that, and I mean this not sarcastically, it's remarkable that it empirically says so much, and yet by the end says nothing at all. There is a great sense of uncanniness. There's a great sense of quiet. It feels like a glass vase that at any moment could just absolutely shatter. Would I recommend reading it, though? If you're interested in the history of pessimistic literature, and if you're interested in Japanese literature, of course, I mean, make up your own mind. But this, of all the books I've reviewed, would be the one where I'm most intrigued as to people's own thoughts on whether or not I've missed something here. But that is my that is my review of Osamu Dazai's No Longer Human. So thanks for listening.